Our gospel passage for this Sunday recounts the experience of the temptation of Christ in the wilderness. Wilderness, in biblical terms, is an untamed, seemingly endless place of barrenness, isolation, loneliness, certainly hunger and thirst. It's the geography of human vulnerability. You can die in the wild. Things in the wilderness can and will destroy you. Also in the wild, in the desert, you might see a mirage. You think that thing up ahead is a pool of refreshing water surrounded by palm trees. It looks like something desirable, but when you trudge to it, you only then discover too late that it was just a mirage, a false image, a false promise. Or to put it in moral terms, a deception. After fasting in the wilderness for weeks and weeks, Jesus is met three times by the deceiver, the adversary, the father of mirages. Ultimate deception arrives in the hiss of the devil. His most potent weapon is the ability to convince people that left is right, down is up, evil is good, mirages are true. There's a reason the devil's called the father of lies. To him, the Son of God, hungry and thirsty in the wilderness, appears vulnerable, finally. From that first moment in Little Bethlehem, the Holy One made the fateful error of taking on human flesh. How foolish. He became like them, with skin that bleeds, and bones that break, and hearts that do too, and eyes that get as big as saucers at mirages, and not just in the desert. And now he's gone to the wilderness and is fully experiencing the raw, extreme edge of the essential materiality of human life. Humans hunger and thirst, and experience exhaustion, and the companion existential crises they almost all deal with in one way or another. Self-doubt, fear, bitterness, loneliness, despair. I don't know for sure that Jesus experienced inner turmoil in those keys, but I've known a few humans, and I know Jesus was one of us, fully human. He was fully God, too. The devil couldn't do much to change fully God, but licked his chops at how he can make miserable anyone fully human. This fragile vessel that can be cracked and shattered if enough pressure is applied in just the right places. Please dismiss the mental image of a red pitchfork and pointy-tailed demon whispering in Jesus' ear, you know, on his shoulder. That's not a temptation, that's a cartoon. Instead, picture the tempter as the voice of relief into the ear of desire. That's temptation. In the film The Last Days in the Desert, Ewan McGregor plays Christ in this moment in his life, a scene in the wilderness, deep in the wilderness of desert geography and his own struggles. The tempter in the movie is also played by Ewan McGregor. The image of the tempter for a man is himself. It's a brilliant piece of filmmaking that resonates with me as a brilliant way to get close to the power, the actual power of temptation for actual humans. The director, Rodrigo Garcia, commented about his film and the way he and Ewan McGregor approach the daunting challenge of depicting Jesus. He said, "I'm not a great fan of those movies where you have the starry-eyed Jesus who barely seems human. And I also thought, if he's in fact human, then the mission and the sacrifices are all the greater. If you're a God, and only a God, then perhaps the crucifixion is not that big a sacrifice. But if you're half human, It's a humongous sacrifice. Now, well-intentioned though it may be, let's first address the heresy of saying Jesus is half human and half God. He's not 50% God, 50% human, balancing it all out. He's the fullness of God and the fullness of man. As the incarnate Son of God, Jesus Christ, is fully divine, fully human, without confusion, without change, without division, without separation. For sure, this is a mystery. What's called the hypostatic union of the two natures of Christ. And I don't mean to pile on a film director who means well, but his film does such an amazing job of exploring the implications of the fullness of Christ's humanity. It's worth pointing out the stumble in his description when Garcia tries to stick the landing. But he helps us remember not to also land on the other side of the heresy, that Jesus is only God, and so doesn't really suffer on the cross or in the wilderness. But, and this is important, Jesus' temptation was to be less than human. He's tempted by three options, each of which is a way to walk away from the essence of human nature. If there could be a one-line summary of them all, it's something like this. Why don't you just be divine without all this messy, painful human stuff? The struggle for Jesus is, can you bear all that it means to be mortal? Can you do it? Once that question slithers up beside him, the temptations fall like hailstones. God's beloved should not have any unmet desire. Turn stones to bread and be filled, and then be a wonder worker who gives people all they desire. They will love you. God's divine one shouldn't walk amongst the poor and the outcast. Take the crowns and the armies and rule them all. They will fear you. God's Messiah shouldn't have to live with vulnerability. God will keep you safe. You will not die. They will not be able to hurt you. It's this last temptation that gives it all away. It's such an enticing lie because it squeezes him and us at just the place where we have deepest fears about what it means to be human in a broken, dangerous world. For Jesus, the road of life on which he's walking comes to a big blinking light that says, dangerous curves ahead, broken pavement, exit here. Exit here and be safe from hunger, vulnerability, and harm, which, as you know, are the tears, the thorns, the nails, and the cross. There's your off-ramp from human life, real human life, full human life. Maybe being half human wouldn't be so bad. The voice is relentless. Yesterday, I was at a store, and my daughter introduced me to this pair of sunglasses that you can put on. They look like normal sunglasses, kind of cool looking. But you put them on, and then, there's music playing. And it's not like it's playing, into your ears. It's like it's playing from your eyeballs. It's like you're enveloped with music. This voice, where is it coming from, singing to me? The voice, put your blinker on, ease over, take the easy way to Messiahship. But the easy way is a mirage. It's a deception. To listen to this voice just coming into your head is to be like Michael Scott driving with Dwight down the road. Michael can't distinguish the voice of deception, turn right here, from the voice of truth. No, Michael, that's not the turn. And so he spins the wheel, takes the turn, and plunges his car down a boat ramp into a lake. Here's Jesus with the voice in his head, all around him, within him. But he stays straight on the road. Eyes ahead. No mirage will fool him. No lie will capture him. No wilderness and no deception will diminish him. He answers each temptation with what I can only guess is what his mama taught him. The scriptures are powerful reminders of who you really are when the wild, the devil, or just life tries to break you. We have our ancient theology of hypostatic union to remind us of the mystery of the two natures of Christ, the fullness of the divine, the fullness of humanity. And we have the temptation story to show us how fully Christ embraced his humanity and stayed on the road, knowing what the cost would be. And yet for all of this, the church has a long history of drifting toward the exit. If not in our doctrine of Christ's natures, which we can recite, then certainly in our own spirituality of Christians as we live them. It seems like the church is that guy driving down the highway with his blinker on, mile after mile after mile, the blinker always on, as if looking for a way out, an off-ramp, an exit sign from the messy humanity and messy relationships. Some people even convince themselves a whole theology that if a person truly believes, then nothing bad's going to happen to them. Having a lot of faith, having the most faith, means that you'll get rich, you're immune from a pandemic, you'll win at everything. I believe I will be protected. There's nothing wrong with a little optimism in life. A bright outlook can motivate good work. Sometimes a little positivity and harder work can bring good outcomes. But this is not what's at stake here. We want to believe the path of faith is a path away from suffering, vulnerability, and pain towards satisfaction, protection, and success, only to have an inconvenient Messiah who just relentlessly won't give up on this idea that the gospel is not the gospel without flesh and blood. On a day when our chalices hold the blood-red wine for the first time in many months, this feels particularly poignant today. And it is nowadays. The world keeps trying to veer off the road of real life, flesh and blood life, a life of food and critters and creatures and trees and air and fresh air and love and sorrow, suffering. A few years ago, I started reading about AI, or artificial intelligence. You can see stories about AI all the time now. The way most people are working on it, or dreaming about it, or worrying about it, has to do with the increasing sophistications of technology and machines to adopt more and more human traits. Reasoning skills, learning skills, perhaps even consciousness. This makes for interesting novels and movies, imagining a time, perhaps dystopian, when robots become more human than machines and take a mind of their own, and then we're in trouble. It's also a surprisingly muddled theological question. If a machine is more like a human, when does it become human? And what does that mean? What rights would it have? How do you relate to a machine that's more human than a hunk of metal? These are the questions that have been swirling around AI. But there are a small group of people on the cutting edge of AI from a completely different direction. It's not the question they're asking when machines can become human. The question they're asking is, how can humans use machines, use technology, to be able to enter into a world of their own creation, to be like gods? According to an interview with Mark Zuckerberg, the founder and CEO of Meta, you know, Facebook, he said, mankind will migrate into the metaverse in the future, leaving reality behind for a world that we create and govern entirely. He claims there will come a moment when virtual worlds are so absorbing and handy that we will not want to leave, at which point the metaverse will emerge. The technology is really amazing if you're into tech, but it's worth pausing here to pay attention to what he said, because he understands what he's saying. Envisioning a world where we leave reality behind for a world we create and govern entirely. This is the dream. And I don't know. That looks a lot like a world where we can turn stones to bread, govern kingdoms if we want to be powerful, and throw ourselves down from the highest peak and not be injured. In other words, we've seen this somewhere before. This idea that life is better if it's not real. The truth is that we're already on the way, and Zuckerberg understands this. He said, while these virtual reality worlds aren't quite there yet, many individuals currently spend much of their time in the digital realm, albeit on two-dimensional displays. He said, a lot of people assume the metaverse is about a location, but one description of it is a period when immersive digital worlds become the primary ways we live our lives and spend our time. The goal is to be able to create totally personalized worlds to your own design. To create totally personalized worlds to your own design. Which sounds really fun as a game, and sounds utterly miserable as a way of life. Whatever else this is and will be for our futures, it is an off-ramp from the world full of desert wilderness and suffering and joy and Jesus as he is. If the cross teaches us anything, it is that God's beloved, precious ones still suffer, still hunger, and still die. And Lent, we are reminded, turn off your turn signal. Return your eyes to the road he leads us on. In Christ, God enters into and loves us in our vulnerabilities, but doesn't love us out of them. This is the amazing thing. Christ could have chosen another way, but fully embraces the scandal of his flesh. In every way, Jesus had another way, always had another way, and chose this one, this path with rocks that still remain rocks and can be thrown at him and one another. And kingdoms that sometimes are taken captive by rulers bent on destroying other people's lives as long as they can. And to danger, even death on a cross, where his body is broken and blood shed. This is the real world. And God came to inhabit this world and redeem this world and give us lives to live in this world. And as we walk these paths, we walk with Christ. The resurrected Christ, who through the Holy Spirit is with us even now. When we walk in strong strides of faith, and when we stumble and fall and faceplant all over ourselves. To all of us, in all these steps of life, now the invitation comes to participate. And the solemn remembrance and embodiment of his death, and thanks be to God, of resurrection from the dead to new life. Let us prepare our hearts to come to the table.